Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the last session of the 2016 General Insurance Seminar. Final plenary session on innovation. Now, that's a scary topic, isn't it? How often do you hear innovation? Immediately go, oh, not another Malcolm Turnbull line. No, not with the panel we've got here today. Not with Tracy Green, Guy Russell, Sam Cokefield and Vicky Marlin. Please welcome them. The challenge, of course, is for innovation to be real, not a cliche, not a Turnbull-esque app phrase, but to actually give your customers more of what they want. So I'm not going to try to talk about it. Instead, our first speaker today is Tracy Green. Tracy heads the Australian Personal Insurance Customer Marketing and Underwriting Teams at IAG. So it's like trying to run the Australian cricket team, the Australian rugby union team and an AFL team all at the one time. Multi-skilled, multi-talented. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Tracy Green.
Thank you very much, Michael. But it would be like running the All Blacks in terms of the New Zealand rugby team. Yes, you've got to stay with the Kiwi heritage. But today I was going to be asked to talk about a bit about innovation and service delivery. And I think, you know, innovation has become the buzzword in respect of what is being talked about within business and through our Prime Minister throughout the centuries. So I thought that I would start by going a little bit back in time to really have a think about, from a service delivery perspective and a context in around that, what really is innovation and service delivery able to deliver? And I do see a few people around who would remember the corner grocery store once upon a time, where the grocer who knew about his customers, when they were coming in, he knew their families, he knew where the key milestone dates of what was important, he knew people's likes and dislikes, he knew how to set out the store in terms of how people wanted to engage and interact. So a very deep, intimate experience in terms of the grocer experience and around service delivery. And that enabled him to optimise his business, to actually deliver great results, to make sure he was ordering right stock on time, but also to deliver quite an intimate customer experience. And really what I'm going to be talking about today is the importance in terms of innovation and service delivery is really coming back to being customer-led and really building that intimacy and that knowledge and understanding associated with the customer. And the challenge for today and in the cusp of the things that we're on, I would say, is how to build that intimacy that the grocer used to provide back in the 1940s and 1950s in a very different world in terms of how we live and engage today. If I then sort of fast forward through to today, and by, you know, the world has changed, hasn't it? I think, I remember when I started working, we still had dumb terminals, email didn't exist, we had dot matrix and printers. We used to do actually all the reinsurance calculations and insurance manually to be able to issue the renewal notices out in terms of an individual quote. So that was the world that I grew up in. But it has changed, and the advent of the cloud, mobile computing, social revolution, globalisation of business, ease of access, ease of travel, the changing family unit and the changing family environment has led to this whole sort of automation in and around business. And when I reflect sort of over the last, you know, 20, 30 years in terms of business environments and how businesses have developed over that period coming from the grocer in terms of where they went, became quite big corporates that provided a good and basic delivery that had breaks in it. But I think the customer sentiment at that point in time would have been, I'm being treated as a number, not as a person. So that was kind of the experience in terms of service delivery through. It became easier, it became quicker, you're able to build and automate in terms of processes, but the connection with the customer that the grocer used to provide was somehow lost in terms of how we were developing businesses in terms of the future. So the cusp in terms of what we are on today is really, you know, big data, machine learning, globalisation, ease of access, speed, really enables us to quite simply deliver the grocer experience in an automated way. And that is really how I would describe thinking about what we are on the verge of being able to create more broadly from an industry perspective in terms of how the customer will demand different levels of service interaction, is that really deep understanding, intimate personal interactions with consumers in terms of the way that they want to be engaged. And isn't that an amazing place to be, I think, from a world that we live in? You know, a world historically where, you know, there weren't computers, email didn't exist, the internet didn't exist, the Apple iPhone didn't exist, to where we are today is that we're going to be building this amazing ability for people to engage in terms of the way that they want. So how well are we doing? And I thought it would be useful, and you know, I thought I'd trot out the Uber experience because everybody uses Uber as kind of one of those examples of something that's taken the world by storm. The thing that I find interesting about Uber initially was it actually delivered a same service in terms of what was being delivered in terms of transporting people. What it did do, though, was actually understand the customer's needs and remove a lot of friction out of that process. So you don't actually need to faff around and pay at the end of the trip. It's kind of all seamless all the way through. So there's this ease of interaction through. So from an experience of using it, really, really well connected. And it also unlocked that sort of latency that was sitting in asset use. So I could actually use my spare time to earn a bit of income on the side in quite an easy way and feel quite protected. And in fact, as a passenger who uses Uber, I can get a new vehicle with somebody who sort of reasonably knows where they're going. So I kind of like that as a service. And it'll be interesting to see where Uber goes in the future. But it is one of those ones that held up. I think, though, fascinating because it really was just customer-led in terms of what really irritates people about getting in a taxi and going from point A to point B, and let's build something that I don't need to own the car, I can get people to engage in, can deliver quite simply, I don't need to buy the assets, and it's caused a world revolution. Now, that didn't happen overnight, and except that, but it does actually show that customer demand will actually push these things through, and we're now seeing governments respond in terms of trying to have a think about the regulatory and legislative environment in terms of supporting these types of services, which makes it interesting in the future, and I think Vicky will probably talk about some of that towards the end as to how do we actually think about, in the world where we're living, with innovation sort of in delivery of service in terms of consumers and what they're demanding, do we actually keep pace and be able to address and keep people safe through the period? The other one, you know, a lot of people talk about innovation and service delivery as that it's going to be digitised, which it will. Digitisation enables us to deliver a lot in terms of service delivery, and that it will kill any face-to-face or service interactions. I would have a different view in and around that, and I think we're seeing lots of examples of, say, some of the financial services and banks who have actually closed down the face-to-face and now actually bringing it back. What I do believe, though, it's going to drive innovation in terms of the way we engage in customers, and it will likely move the sort of basic transactional processes that were traditionally delivered through face-to-face, that'll be removed, and it will be a much different experience. And if you think about that grocer, there will be a sort of intimacy in terms of experience in the way that customers can connect and through. This is an example of the sort of kiosk type of styles that can be experimented and tested in terms of real time with customers, in terms of how they're wanting to engage. And we're seeing these type of stores pop up over and about the place. You can change them quickly. They're really low cost. They've obviously got a lot of lower rental. And so you're delivering this far more intimate customer experience at a much lower cost base through the innovation that's been put in in terms of some of that service design. You'll then see, I think, in terms of these types of hubs and models, and you're seeing it within a lot of the financial services now, particularly the banks. Insurers are a bit slower in around this, but coming through in terms of engagement and around the data, the sharing of the data, and letting people access the insights that are actually quite important in quite a physical way, even though it's digitised. From an insurance perspective, because it's the industry I work in, I'm probably a bit more critical in and around how quickly the insurance industry has innovated. You know, it's very traditional business, but there is innovation happening, and I've got a picture of one of the drones up there. So we've seen drone technology being used and tested and trialled and around the world in different types of ways in insurance companies. It's predominantly been used at the moment in terms of claims spaces, and you know the ability to get in quickly after bushfires to be able to assess even before people can access in there whether the property is still there or not, and actually letting the customer know whether their property has survived, and in fact paying the claim before they've even been able to return to the property, so letting them know what their situation is. And that's probably where it's sort of played within the Australian space. There's a lot more happening in the US space with some of the insurers and around there. The other thing in terms of drones is the ability to collect data, right, and produce data in a more cost-effective manner. The fact that you can sort of take those insights from the data and build an experience with the customer that far more suits them and is far more personal is really, in my view, the next step associated with the use of this type of technology. I couldn't go without a bit of a plug for the company I work for, so I've got up here. We're a lot of insurers actually are using and thinking about what I call sharing the risk insights, or enabling the customer to actually understand what it is that we know so they can do something about it. And we're seeing different insurers play around in this space. Obviously, the Safer Homes is using the spatial ability or the mapping ability, using historical claims data to let people interact to see what are the big risks associated with the property that they live in. So if you haven't been on that site, you can pop in and have a look. There's other instances where that's been played around with, say, weather alerts is one that's used now more broadly across the insurance industry in terms of letting customers know when big storms or fires or warnings are coming down that would likely affect their property. And in fact, a lot of the research sort of coming back from that type of innovation is, you know, customers saying yes, they actually do something about it when they get the information to protect their property, because isn't that a good thing? And in fact, they share it. So I think in some of the research I've seen, probably about 80 to 90% of people are sending that to family and friends and around the community. So you think about that on a more sort of globalised scale in terms of how you can take that type of interaction and share the knowledge that sort of sits within corporates quite to an intimate level with the customer that they can connect with. It builds those deeper risk insights, but it's a win-win for the organisation, because the business we're in terms of insurance is protection of people and protection of their assets. So there's some of the examples, and I think we all know those when we kind of have a think about the world in terms of changing. I think that sort of reflection back to the grocer to where we are today. And thinking about what it is from a business model into the future in terms of how we're going to have to set ourselves up on a corporate basis to enable us to remain relevant in this world that we're living in, enable us to respond pretty quickly as customer demand starts to move, and it can move quite quickly. You know, I would give an example where, you know, which I always quite kind of like a good drug story, so I try to tell this one wherever I go, but it's a New Zealand story and possibly a warning for Australia. But the methamphetamine contamination claims in New Zealand skyrocketing, right? So customers are really concerned that they're living in properties where their family are going to be contaminated with ice, so methamphetamine ice. So get sick, get injured, and so there's a lot of claims coming on through. So you think about this from a service delivery and why is it happening? Now, the reason why that's happening in New Zealand is there's been this little startup company who has managed to get in and offer a service which has got quite high demand for quite a low cost, so I think it's about $50, where before somebody rents a property or buys a property, they can do a methamphetamine test. And as a result of that methamphetamine test, it's showing contamination in the property, which is driving the claims. Now, from an insurance perspective and a service perspective where we wanted to look after our customers, we've never envisaged that as a risk. So we don't have historical claims in around it. We've never thought about how we could cover that or the interactions in terms of the in terms of how we protect our customers. And it takes us a while to change our policies. So when we think about business models, we've got to get better at using the data that's available to us, and it's not just the traditional data that we've had. So how do we pull all these sort of big points of data together? So there is this investment in analytics. There's the understanding of the customer and that deep engagement in terms of the customer in respect of what's important to them. We need to simplify our traditional business models to enable that sort of agility to respond. And I would say, finally, we have to look to partnerships to really broaden out our capability because the world is changing. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Tracy. Now we know the All Blacks, they're just high on ice the whole time. That's why they're going so flat out. How good was that Irish rugby union team in Chicago? I just don't know why that came to mind. Thank you very much, Tracy. Next speaker is Guy Russell. He is a business strategy executive in financial services strategy with Accenture, specialising in insurance and capital markets, and in particular, in recent years, in that technology stuff. Please welcome Guy Russell.
Thank you. So our research says that about 30 to 40% of EBITDA is at risk to players who don't respond in the insurance industry to all the digital threats, entrants, connected devices, Internet of Things, and all those good things. Personally, I'm not so sure. I fundamentally think there's two things that are kind of going against that. First of all, risk exposure in the world as a whole isn't decreasing. And secondly, appetite for mitigating that risk isn't decreasing either. So actually, I think now there's a massive opportunity for insurance to help shape the world we live in and to be centre stage for that development. There's no doubt there'll continue to be a shift in ownership of that liability, but fundamentally, if anything, exposures to things that can go wrong, in layman's terms, isn't changing. If anything, it's actually increasing. So, a topic I'd like to share a couple of things on is Internet of Things, or IoT, which I think is the single biggest opportunity for insurance today. It gets a lot of attention these days, and I think is worth unpicking a bit, because often things with lots of media attention get slightly misunderstood, as perhaps we saw in the US last week, I'm not sure. First of all, I think IoT suffers a bit from its name. I think Internet of Things sounds like something out of a kind of a horror film or like a Freddy Krueger type thing. It sounds kind of at best obscure and kind of at worst kind of deliberately obscure. So I guess the kind of the best way to start is probably with a definition, very long form. But the Internet of Things is a technical and business paradigm whereby devices equipped with contextual intelligence interact with their environment either passively, sensing, or actively actuating, and also collaborate effectively with other smart objects, humans, or applications on a network. Very long-winded way of saying, essentially, connected devices. Essentially, it means anything from a smartphone to a sensor to a light bulb being connected to the internet. Anything connected to the internet. So today that's mostly laptops and phones, but other things like babies' dolls and so on that we've seen already, but who knows, maybe even there's ingestibles, you know, there's certainly farm tracking from table to food. There's bandages that connect to the internet and respond to the way that your skin is healing. All kinds of things that we're expecting to see in the future. So I guess the reason there's so much hype about it, really, I think, is kind of twofold. Firstly, this is basically the latest in a line of developments of what a computer looks like. Initially, we had kind of big blue chunky screens, and then we had laptops, and then the big phones that you see, and then they got smaller and smaller, and tablets, and now cars. But essentially now, the hardware's got so small that almost anything can be connected to the internet. And if it isn't small enough yet, it's about to be. So predictions of the number of connected devices to the internet vary a huge amount, from 10 billion by 2020 up to 50 billion, if you believe Salim Ismail from Exponential Organizations, who built the Singularity University. To put that in some context, there are anticipated to be, by 2020, more connected devices or things than there will be connected phones, tablets, and computers put together, even despite the exponential growth in phone penetration. Another example, there's currently about 40 million Americans wearing wearables, connected devices. By 2018, that's expected to double. As the price of microchips, storage, computer processing power all continue to fall exponentially, we will, as you said before, have an abundance of data from all these billions of sensors. The second reason for all the hype, I think, is the potential impact of all these connected devices on the world. Our research guys have confidently predicted that Internet of Things is going to have a $14.2 trillion impact on the global economy by 2030. I'm not sure about the point two, but there's no doubt it's going to have a massive impact, and lots of research backs that up. But I think the bigger point is not just on GDP, but on other sort of larger questions like climate change through sensor technology. Estimates are that the average electricity bill could be cut by 50%, 70%. Poverty and hunger through smart agriculture and use of drones for distribution. Lifespan. I guess the prize of abundance, as it's termed, is there for everyone to imagine. So I guess, what's the reality, though? How do we actually get there? Well, I suppose if you look at where IoT is currently, this is probably a bit small to read, but if this is a sort of an S-curve of development of technologies from emerging on the left through to improving to mature, aging, you've got mainframes over on the right-hand side, you've got the kind of enterprise systems as mature, analytics is probably just about improving. Where would you put IoT? Well, most research basically suggests that IoT is at the very early stage of its life cycle. You can split it into two, as we have done here, between sensors and authentication, and maybe you put sensors further up than authentication, but either way, it's still very, very early. Tony Fadell, who founded Nest, compared where we are currently with IoT to where we were with electricity in the 1800s. He said that basically no one in the 1800s dreamt up televisions and microwaves. So it's all very well to see the potential of it, but how do you envision it and achieve it? I guess there are some exceptions where we're already reasonably developed. And I think Tony is in a particular position because he founded Nest and he's dealing with all kinds of sort of home electronics and the interaction between them. I'll steer clear of talking about some of the innovations in vehicle technology because I think Sam's coming on to that. But an example might be precision agriculture. You may have seen this type of model before, but essentially these agri-tools nowadays can go up and down a row of crops or plants. They can sense what's in the soil, sense what's missing. In the olden days, they used to then spray them or to kill the weeds. Now they don't do that because that's not organic anymore. A mechanical arm comes out, pulls out the weed, and puts it in the back. It's pretty extraordinary. And of course, all this solar-powered. So for me, I think the point is that IoT is being done in pockets. Things like data standards and regulation are still quite a long way from being resolved. An example of an issue with this, as I'm sure you can imagine, is how do you get your Hitachi TV remote to talk to your Sony stereo? It's, you know, it's as simple as, you know, it's not that easy. So, what does all this mean for insurance? Well, I think for IoT to have a direct impact on insurance, it needs to be combined. It can't be on its own. It needs to be with smart contracts and e-underwriting. A simple example is comprehensive car insurance that only kicks in once a GPS signal has signaled that the car has left the garage. Sounds simple enough, right? But the reality of making this happen at scale is a different thing. How do you know that the car was actually in the garage and not just parked next to it? What if the GPS signal isn't specific enough to know who's driving? Or what about data privacy? There's a lot of these issues, and they can be addressed. And there's a view, I guess, that says that consumption-based insurance models will reduce premiums. But the reality for me, not being an actuary, is that that kind of usage model has been factored into models already. It's not a new thing. Yes, it may reduce premiums a little bit, but it won't have that much of a devastating impact. Use isn't something that hasn't been thought of before. Connected devices and sensors will mean there's essentially a lot more data, but that data isn't necessarily available to insurance, and it isn't something that hasn't been estimated to some extent in the past. So I think one thing that's interesting is to look at the amount of venture capital activity that's going on in IoT. Again, you probably can't see that very much, but essentially there was a huge amount of investment in IoT over the last 3 years. Recently, that's actually started to decline a little bit. Some say we're going through the kind of the trough of despair, if you know the sort of the development model. But essentially, there's been a growth in some sectors, like industrial, wearables, home and robotics, but actually a decline in other areas. So drones, actually, and infrastructure, health, and auto and transport. One of the problems with IoT, I think, is what Google's cult McCandless calls the tax of battery and data usage. So you imagine walking through a shopping center. The shops have all got their analytics, all knowing what kind of customer you are, all pinging you with lots of adverts and videos streaming and all the rest of it. Pretty soon it gets pretty annoying. Your battery starts running down, you're being charged for all this data that you don't really want. Easily enough, you just turn it off. These types of problems haven't been resolved yet. And so much as there's much capability there, the actual reality of making it happen is something else. So what does the kind of the threat of all this mean for insurance? Well, I look at it with something of a traditional lens. Essentially, I think that IoT is enabling people to kind of push the boundaries of what's possible. Getting billions of remote sensors to identify and respond to particular stimuli in order to optimize the use of resources and output definitely falls into that category, and insurance has a key part to play. The devices, as mentioned before, have been built to be very low cost and minute. They haven't been built for reliability and security. We probably all read about the Chinese hackers who took control of a Tesla from 12 miles away. But I understand there was also a hack in the US Chamber of Commerce, and the intrusion was found to be out through a connected thermostat. Printers are another area of opportunity for hackers. So who's going to truly understand and drive the valuation of all this cybersecurity risk? And who will take responsibility if a sensor fails and there's some massive cost implication or lives threatened? Who needs to truly understand the risks associated with these minute, highly low-cost sensors connected to remote controllers sitting miles away and responding to according to their big data algorithms? For me, it's insurance. This is why it's such a big opportunity. It's the same for me as the ships going back into the unknown, dealing with the perils of the sea, as you all remember from Lloyd's back in whenever it was, 1688. For me, essentially, connected devices means there's more risk. There's a greater likelihood of a sizable impact when something goes wrong and there is a claim. The other thing is that all this data that's available should be used and can be used to do more specific underwriting based on the individual rather than just the category. It should enable insurers, if they can control it, to prevent rather than merely respond after the fact. The availability of data via connected devices enables insurers to truly differentiate their offerings through preventative actions rather than fall into a commodity space that some find themselves in today. IoT basically enables you to understand the physical using the virtual. The GPS can tell you where you live, where you have coffee, tell you all sorts of things. Going back to Uber, they recently said that they can tell which of their drivers are having affairs based on their GPS data. So one last thing I'd like to talk about is essentially, what do we do about it? Well, for me, the answer is not nothing, something. Do something to make a choice to innovate and participate rather than wait and worry about the threat of others. For me, taking agency is key to combat the organizational inertia that's paralyzed so many large corps that we've seen disappear over the last couple of decades, like Kodak, for example. I'll leave you with a quote from Salim Ismail that I quite like. If you aren't disrupting your business or industry, someone else is. Thank you.
So while you're all sitting here, someone's back disrupting your industry and business. It was a big mistake to take 2 days out. No, that's not what you mean. It's not. Guy is not an actuary. Neither is Sam Cofield. She's an economist, which is a lot better than being a journalist. But is it good as being an actuary? I don't know. Sam Cofield is Senior Manager Road Safety at the Transport Accident Commission in Victoria. She's got the responsibility for the road safety message. Saving lives. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sam Cofield.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to talk a little bit about how we're viewing innovation and technology in terms of saving lives, and particularly about how we're looking at the automation of vehicles. Story starts a couple of years ago when the Victorian Government asked us to develop a new strategy in terms of road safety and asked us specifically to reduce fatalities on Victoria's road by 20% and serious injury by 15%. So we went about this, I suppose, in quite a scientific way, and did a lot of background work, a lot of evaluation, and particularly looked, I suppose, to the world's mega trends to see where are things going and where can we make the most impact. In developing this strategy and putting a lot of effort into it, we were not looking just to what we could achieve by 2020, but actually achieve in the longer term and make sure that we were setting ourselves up for success to deliver what we hope the government would launch and has since launched, which is a long-term strategy where we expect to see nobody killed or seriously injured on our roads, which is towards zero. Looking at the mega trends, what we found was that, no surprise, our population is ageing. The over 65 age group is growing twice as fast as any other group. In road safety terms, that's not good news. Older people's crash risk isn't that much greater than the general population, and certainly no greater than young people, but they are very frail. So once they're in a crash, they tend to die fairly quickly and get very seriously injured and don't recover quickly from those serious injuries. The population is growing and it's becoming urbanised. In some ways, it becoming urbanised is a good thing for road safety. We actually see that congestion is the road safety practitioner's friend. Cars go slower, they're less likely to impact each other. Even if they do, that's a very low-speed crash and less likely to injure. But if we move to looking at issues such as energy and climate and global warming, we see people wanting to overcome the issues associated with that through use of different forms of transport, such as bike, the push bike, being a pedestrian, but also using motorcycles, which is a fairly high-risk form of transport. And we look at connectivity and where the world's going, and I'm really pleased, Guy, that our connectivity figure is the same, that by 2020 we're expecting about 50 billion things to be connected. For us, that's great because it offers opportunity in terms of vehicles and roads talking to each other, but it's also problematic because as people become more connected to things, they're really unwilling to let go even when they're driving a car. And already we're facing this issue that no matter what we intervene with in terms of mobile phone use and connectivity in cars, people are not willing to engage. They expect to be engaged in their phones more than their driving task. Just in terms of developing that strategy, you don't need to worry too much about the detail here, but we did quite a bit of modelling work. And if you just have a look at the blue line up the top, that's what we expected to happen in Victoria. So if we did nothing else but what we were doing right then in terms of road safety activity. The red line shows what was going to happen when we added a $1 billion infrastructure program that we were already investing in. So it was basically saying that the story was pretty bad at the start. It was a bit better because we invested $1 billion in road infrastructure. But then when we talked about having vehicle safety improvements, vehicle technologies, you can see the green line there. It's actually where we got the biggest gains. So when developing this new strategy, we were really looking for two key initiatives to drive road trauma down and to invest in for the future. In doing that, we made a decision that in the short to medium term, infrastructure was fairly much going to be where our investment was. But in the longer to medium term, longer term, we could very much see that automated vehicles and connected vehicles were going to be the future because, as I said, we've already invested $1 billion in infrastructure and you could see that didn't get us near as far as the vehicle safety did. We very much looked to say, well, where is the future for automated vehicles and what can we look to? And it just so happened that the National Transport Commission, NTC, was doing a very big study looking at how we could introduce automated vehicles and what the environment in Australia was like for early uptake. And really, this quote is just one of many, which is the same thing. It really offers a huge possibility of changing the transport task and society itself. It's likely it'll improve road safety, mobility, productivity and the environment. Why we like this is that we know road safety doesn't sell. Talk to people about safety and their level of interest is pretty low, but people's interest in mobility and getting places faster, more easily, productivity in terms of commercial enterprises and environmental outcomes are all things that sell. So suddenly we can connect road safety to things that people are interested in being involved in the community. We already can see in countries where we've been able to introduce some level of automation that we're seeing great improvements in terms of the number of casualty accidents in the world. These figures are actually between 2003 and 2013, so they're a little bit old, but the only ones that we could get for a conference last month. What you can see is the countries that are fairly early adopters of vehicle technology, particularly Germany and the US, you can see that their casualty numbers are going down. Countries where there's far less regulation and far less interest in terms of vehicles in technology and vehicle safety, such as Brazil, you'll see that their casualty accidents are still going up. So we can see where we can actually improve the safety of vehicles. We can get a pretty good result fairly quickly. The real problem for road safety as, I suppose, an international issue is that because the countries where safety and vehicle safety isn't currently a priority, and countries such as Brazil, Africa, some of the Asian countries, we've still got a huge task and we've got 1.3 million people dying each year. So we've still got a huge task worldwide. Just in terms of where we're at right now, in terms of, I suppose, automated technology, we've really been fairly early adopters in Australia. We've already got cars that have low levels of life-saving automated technology. It's already estimated around 37% of crashes that we've got on the road can already be eliminated or the severity mitigated by the technologies such as auto emergency braking. Auto emergency braking is expected to reduce rear-end crashes by about 35% altogether, mitigate about another 50% of rear-end crashes. Electronic stability control, it's now compulsory on all new vehicles in Australia. Reduces single vehicle crashes by about 30%. So already we're seeing this technology on our roads. But higher levels of technology, higher levels of automation are coming soon. We expect to see commercially deployed high-end automated technology on our roads by about 2020. And this is really good news in terms of road safety, in terms of the number of people being killed and injured, because we estimate that 90% of all crashes are caused or contributed to by human error. Humans are making mistakes and it's ending up in crashes. If we can actually remove the human error from the equation, so if we can automate vehicles, we've got a really good chance of heading towards that zero fatality number that we're eventually aiming for. And you can see that it really is starting to happen. Those first, life-saving technologies, the automatic ones, started in the late 90s. Mercedes introduced electronic stability control then. We're now starting to see systems aimed at avoiding or mitigating crash scenarios, certain crash scenarios like run-off road. About 60% of our crashes in rural Victoria leading to serious injury are run-off road, both to the left and across centre line, often to the right. Scenarios where we're changing lanes and running into motorcyclists, scenarios where we're running into pedestrians and cyclists. Vehicles can already take control of those situations and start to avoid the crashes altogether. All of these, technologies rely on sensors to make decisions. It's laser systems, radar systems, cameras are incredibly important, and positioning technologies that keep us within our lanes. But they're all contributing, and we've got them all available right now. They're all on cars right now. It's just how we develop them and how we use them. Some really good examples of where we're going in terms of technologies, I suppose, in the next couple of years. Driver distraction. We know that it accounts for around 30%, and this is probably a conservative estimate, 30% of casualty crashes on our roads, especially mobile phone use. As I said before, connectivity means people don't want to leave connectivity at home or in the boot. They want to be connected even during their drive. So it's a pretty useless exercise for us to continue to talk to people about mobile phone use. In a behavioural sense, we think that people have probably gone as far as they can, and we've got younger people who have been connected since the day they were born coming onto the roads now. So the task is actually just getting harder. But if we can develop vehicles that won't leave their lanes, that detect pedestrians, that ensure that braking is done automatically, we've got a much better chance of reducing trauma. So relying on technology rather than human behaviour is probably the way to go in terms of looking at distractions such as mobile phone use. And similarly with drowsy driving, we've been educating the community, not only Victoria but Australia-wide, for over 30 years about the fact that it's not a great idea to drive when fatigued. We often do end up in trees or into other vehicles. again, things like autonomous emergency braking can really assist, because the car is going to detect the other vehicle and start to brake for you. We've been grappling with these issues for 30 years or so. Technology is going to be the only way we can see to move forward. A big thank you to Bosch for this slide. They developed it for a recent conference we were at, talking about intelligent transport. But you can see from this slide that really we're looking at a graduated approach to automated driving. We're really in that first stage right now where our driving is being assisted. I'm thinking about, a lot of cars already have park assist and help us with that. Very soon we can see car parks where your car will be able to automatically park itself. It's only a couple of years away on Bosch's, technology ladder. If we move into 2 or 3 years away, highway assist, where basically the car will be able to drive itself on a highway, it's not that far away. Tesla and a few other vehicles such as Mercedes are pretty much there. You can do that if the law allows right now. The driver must remain in control, but the car can do most of the task, can also maintain safe distance from other vehicles and ensure that you remain within the speed limit. Moving to a bit further distance of the future, but not all that far, you know, our highway pilot pretty much says we can set our destination and from a highway, and it will almost get us there automatically. Again, we're still supposing that the driver will be in charge of the car, but it will be so automated that potentially, if the law allows, you'll be able to drive while undertaking other tasks, and hence me talking about mobile phone use and fatigue. So what are the current barriers we're facing? And they're fairly large, and they mainly relate to regulation. Our current regulations, our state-based regulations, don't really support automated vehicles on our roads. We still have inconsistent law across all jurisdictions, and it's a fairly complex regulatory framework. If we're going to do anything about that, if we're going to introduce technology fairly quickly, we're going to need to deal with that. Interestingly, today the NTSC actually announced they are going to do that, and reform is going to happen. It will be coordinated. I think the key really is that we've got to allow trials. We need to be able to have trials on our roads, and that means that insurers of all sorts, third-party property damage insurers, commercial insurers are going to need to sort of get on and have a look at how we can get demonstrations for early uptake. We need to really look at the law that says that a human must be in control of a vehicle. It's really unclear right now when the car takes over who is in control and how the law treats that. And really, does proper control of a vehicle mean that you must have, as we have for the last 100 years, a hand on the wheel? We've got to look very much at third-party injury insurance and see how that will be applied, because clearly we can't leave people uninsured when they've been injured. So morally, that's a really important issue for us. We've got to work out how government's going to control data, access data, and how privacy laws will be applied and how people's data will be looked after. And, of course, there's the cyberspace issues that Guy already spoke to. Just in closing, we are very much aware that all of these issues will take time to deal with, but one of the ways to actually start dealing with the barriers and the issues that we face, particularly the regulatory ones, are literally to push the boundaries. So the TAC has actually worked with Bosch and Vic Roads in Victoria to develop a car which can operate with a driver but in fully automated mode. So it uses all the sensors and the cameras that I talked about before. But it's being used particularly to test our laws, to understand what changes we need to make on Victoria's roads, and to also understand how far the technology will take us before we need other interventions in terms of road safety. Thank you.
And there's a whole seminar's worth of questions just in that topic along the way. Our final speaker in this session, Vicky Mullen. Her career's on a downhill slide. A lawyer by training, 20 years. She once worked for the Actuaries Institute, but then Financial Services Council, now the Insurance Council of Australia, where she is the General Manager of Consumer Relations and Market Development. It's very good, but it's not the Actuaries Institute. Please welcome Vicky anyway.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me. I'd like to start off with a statement. We are dealing with one big, massive global mood disorder. We've had Brexit, we've had Trump, and I think what we're concerned about at the Insurance Council is that the insurance industry is certainly not immune from the mood disorder. What I'm talking about is that big T word, trust. What I'm about to show you here is a little bit of a tsunami of discontent. We have seen examples, particularly over the last couple of years, where the industry has really been struggling, I think, in how it's dealing with consumer issues. So I'd like to pose the question, take the future and bring it actually back right to the here and now, and actually ask the question, how can we innovate today to deal with some of the really, really critical and difficult consumer issues that we're facing. And that just gives you a little bit of a flavour with what we've been dealing with in recent months and years. We at the Insurance Council deal daily with politicians, with regulators, with the media, with consumer advocates. We hear this stuff all the time, and it doesn't appear to be going away. Just to give you a little bit of an idea of just a bit of a backfilled timeline of what we're dealing with, if I go back to the financial crisis that kicked off in 2008, it was very much the global banking industry in the frame. Even when we got to our own financial systems inquiry a couple of years ago, I think it would be fair to say that it again was principally the banks that were in the crosshairs and were the ones who got the most of the attention. We certainly witnessed through the course of that inquiry that the panel that was running the inquiry was struggling a little bit to find, you know, what it could say about the insurance industry. It gave us some tasters. It talked about a little bit about effective disclosure. It talked a little bit about how regulators might have better powers in relation to product oversight, but that was 2 years ago. And again, just emphasising that what we've seen, particularly in the last 12 months, has been constant talk about a Royal Commission into the retail banking sector and talk at the fringes about whether such an inquiry might actually start to look into the behaviour of insurance, both life and general insurance. Since then, we've also had ASIC's quite detailed report on add-on insurance through car yards. We've had a Victorian Ombudsman's report into the management of claims in the Victorian Workers' Comp Scheme. We've had Jeff Summerhayes, the insurance member for APRA, very directly talking about issues of trust, social licence and conduct risk, which I witness as a new development from the prudential regulator. That's normally the sort of language we would see coming out of ASIC. We've now got APRA using that kind of language, and we've got APRA talking about how it can work with ASIC in those domains. ASIC has just done a review of life insurance claims. ASIC has an enforcement review task force. The recent annual report of the Ombudsman Service has witnessed a significant spike in general insurance disputes. We have an independent review of the EDR scheme. We have reviews underway of the of the Banking Industry Code of Conduct. The life insurers have just released their code, and we at the Insurance Council are about to go into another review of our code, which was only reviewed comprehensively 2 years ago. So it is a tsunami of activity in the conduct and the consumer space. I was around when HIH collapsed. Back in 2001, I worked at the Insurance Council on the team that dealt with the Royal Commission back then. I have not seen this level of activity around conduct consumer issues for the insurance industry since the collapse of HIH. So we've got an awful lot to deal with. So how can innovation help us now? What I've done there, I've put up a list. This is just a bit of a brain dump for me as to where I think we really need some help. So the challenge I've got for the industry and all of the professionals and experts that help the industry to do their job well is to ask yourself the question, what can be done in the here and now to help us out with the variety of consumer issues that we're dealing with? We need transparent sales processes. We need far more effective disclosures. We need really good value products that are fit for purpose in every single case. We need better data to back up the legal exclusions we've got, if you like, from the anti-discrimination laws. We need much better claims management in both the property and the personal injury space. We need far more effective dispute resolution. We need products that are available for all Australians. There are currently 2 million Australians that meet the category of being financially excluded. That's in Australia. That's an astonishing figure. We need to deal with vulnerable consumers, and we need to deal much better with people who have mental health issues. So here are some ideas. Again, it's just a bit of a shopping list that I've come up with very quickly, but these are some of the issues that we're thinking about at the Insurance Council. And I'm very optimistic about some of the activities that we're seeing where innovation really actually can help us in the here and now. I think there's already been a lot of talk about big data. I think you've heard a lot about that over the last couple of days. Clearly, big data, really good effective data sets, can absolutely help with risk mitigation. That's with natural perils and with cyber. I think cyber is obviously going to be a very exciting space. I would like to imagine a world with effective disclosure, for example, where someone can have an interactive PDS. And what I mean by that is, if you think about home and two of the big retail products in our space, home and motor, they're probably, for both of those products, there are probably between 5 to 15 key questions that consumers need answered very quickly, so they can actually test themselves very easily whether a particular product is actually fit for their purpose. So I'd like to imagine a world where someone can actually fill in a quick checklist, and that checklist would back generate a bespoke statement to that person about whether that product is fit for their purpose or not. So I think there's a lot there that technology can provide with effective disclosure. Again, other mechanisms to help people make appropriate choices with financial services, calculators, simple advice models. I think we're going to be continuing to have conversations around those issues over the coming years. Another area that I'm particularly interested in is what I'm calling trickle-up product design. What do I mean by that? I'd love to see the industry really asking the question, what do people really want? And I think we've got a couple of amazing examples in the marketplace at the moment of trickle-up product design. The two products that I'm talking about are bespoke products that have been developed by one by Suncorp and one by IAG that have been specifically designed for people on low incomes. And the way both of those organisations have developed those products is they've gone out into the field, they've partnered up, and we've already talked about partnerships, they've partnered up with organisations that are on the ground with people across our communities who are really struggling, and they've asked those people, what do the people you represent, what do they need? And these products for people on low incomes have literally been designed from the ground up. They didn't adapt an existing product. They went right back to the drawing board and designed a new product. And I think that both of those organisations need to be really clearly congratulated, because I know it wasn't easy and they've both managed to do it. And I think that's a great example of how the industry can actually be innovative right now. Clearly, a lot of you know about the potential for enhanced efficiencies in supply chains for repairs for cars or for homes or for products, for contents. Another area that I'd really like to focus on is a lot of work we're doing at the Insurance Council at the moment is looking into how we can better support people with personal injuries, whether those people have a liability claim, a CTP claim, or a workers' compensation claim. I think the real challenge there is how do we use technology, how do we innovate to create seamless information flows between employees or injured, someone who's been injured in a motor vehicle accident, employers, treating practitioners and insurers. My understanding is that the flow of information between those parties is currently very clunky. Parties along that chain don't really understand the needs of the other parties, and it can just, you know, patch in a whole lot of time and frustration that is just not necessary. So I think technology and innovation is going to really deliver a lot over the coming years to really assist people back to work, back to their lives, back to school, whatever it might be. I put blockchain on the slide. I don't know what that is. I'm hoping someone else here does. But I did recently read about a global collaboration between some really big insurers to look at how blockchain can assist with real-time claims processing. So I'm trying to sound like I'm smart, but I'm not. I don't really know what that means. But it sounds really, really exciting, so I stuck it on the slide. And just finally, a sort of an overarching theme is, again, getting back to this idea about how can technology and innovation assist the industry to develop products that are not just for people like me, middle-aged, middle-class. How do we develop products that are relevant and of value to every single person in the community? Because everybody needs insurance protection. It is critical to people's financial resilience. And that's the end of my lecture. I'd like to say I think it's a tremendously exciting time, but I think what we've seen in the last couple of years really helps, gives us some pointers as to what we need to do. Thank you.